take my hand.
Walk with me on the path of life.
Let's discover
one another on the
way.
Meet me out beyond the daily this and that of life.
Together we'll encounter
each other. Come hold me and show me a picture of your soul. I'll touch there so sweetly and feel my love unfold. Hold me in your heart. Remember me with every breath. Let's create the world I'm dreaming of. Be so you can hear the quiet mystery of love.
That was a very gentle song, Quiet Mystery, sung by Mortonette from her album Mortonette Sings. You're listening to VBS Radio. The show is Sound Health, and I'm Sherry Edwards, your host. On this show, we attempt to bring you ideas and information that support your self-health. We realize that we live in a time and people want to take self-responsibility for their own emotions and their ideas and their life, and so we attempt to bring you guests that can add to that wealth of information about yourself. So most of the regular listeners know that I run an institute called Sound Health, and that we attempt to use low-frequency sound, like brainwaves, that low, to investigate health and wellness topics. And one of those ideas we've been investigating recently is anti-aging. Our guest today has written a fictional account of that very subject. The book is immortal. Our guest is Tracy L. Slatton. We'll be with her in just a few minutes. I think you'll find Tracy herself and her novel very enlightening, so stay tuned. We just have a few announcements, and I'll try to get through them really quick. Well, many of you wrote to us asking if we would post pictures of the open house that you missed. Some of you were so intrigued by the event that we talked to you about it before and after and invited you over. So Heather, she's our media coordinator, if you're a first-time listener, she wants me to tell you that she's going to be posting some pictures on the site on BBS. And also, for those of you who have requested that we set up a camera in the studio here so that you can see what we're doing, she asks that you do two things. Either open a Skype account, and that's just Skype, SKYPE.com, or there's an easier way where she can put a link to our studio camera online, but that takes a little more room from your computer. And we had a special request from Matt from Manchester. He didn't say if that was from England or Connecticut. So, Matt, you wanted us to repeat the address for our online Journal of Bioacoustic Biology. Okay, Matt, it is JBAB, Justice Bad Apple Boy. org. It's free, and you can just jump on there and read all the articles about the research that we do. Okay. Tracy Slatton, welcome to the show, and thanks for being with us.
Hi, Sherry. Thanks for having me.
I am intrigued by your book. I had a hard time putting it down. I had a hard time getting my work done today.
Well, I'm happy to hear you enjoyed it.
Tracy, it says in your literature that you're a high school dropout, but a graduate of Yale and Columbia. That's kind of a strange combination. How'd that happen? And if it's none of my business, just say that too.
Well, it just sort of worked out that way. I was an ambitious student and managed to complete a lot of my, most of my course requirements early, and so I applied to Yale out of my junior year and was accepted. So it just sort of came about.
Your book, Immortal, can you give us a real, well, I don't want to say quick summary, but I don't want you to give all of it away either. It's really getting some good reviews. Amazon gives it 4.5 points. I understand this is your first fictional piece.
Yes, Immortal's my first novel, and I say that it's a rags to riches to burnt at the stake story.
Wait, that's a lot. What's the genre it's set in?
It's historical fiction. It's set in Renaissance Florence, and the main character is a man named Luca Bastardo, and he's called that because he doesn't know who his parents are. And the story opens, and he's a foundling on the streets.
There's such a fascination with this idea of romance and magic and Burned at the Stake and Harry Potter and the Da Vinci Code and The Secret. A lot of people write about it, but yours is so well-written and well-researched. Some of the reviews say, this is from Dr. Jonathan, looks like Dolehenty. I read quite a few popular new novels during the course of a year, and I generally don't write reviews about them. Now and then, however, a novel comes along that really impresses me, and indeed, I think may well become a classic piece of literature. Immortal by Tracy Slatton, her first historical novel, is just such a work. That's incredibly high praise. Now, just not one. Everybody who reads your book, brimming with authentic historical detail, I mean, it's just, people are accepting this. Did you think that was going to happen?
Well, I didn't know. I wanted to write a story that was meaningful and that had, I'm married to a classical figurative sculptor, Sabin Howard, and we've been to Italy many times, and Sabin is one of the foremost proponents that the Italian Renaissance is alive and well. So I've fallen in love with Renaissance art and with the characters of Renaissance art like Giotto and Da Vinci and Michelangelo. So I wanted a character who would meet my heroes. And I just wanted to tell a story that would move people and include my Renaissance heroes.
What does it take to do an historical novel? This is not a little book. Did you have to go study about it? Did you listen to what your husband had to say? Is it from your own soul? How do you start something like this?
You know, all of the above, I think, Sherry. My husband Sabin owns every book on the Renaissance imaginable because he sculpts very much in the manner of Michelangelo, and he's very aware of the tradition out of which he comes. So I was lucky because I have a library of Renaissance art history books built in my house. You know, it's right already here. And I did a lot of research in Italy and a lot of online research and talked to different people. Professor James Beck at Columbia spent some time with me at one point sort of going over some of my research, which was very kind of him. He's recently deceased, which is too bad. And I read a million books. I wanted to get the details right for the story.
How long did your preparation take to do this?
Well, it was about, I started the story in about September of 2004. And the final draft was done in August of 2007.
3 years.
3 years, yes.
You know, this brings me to something you said your husband was a sculptor in the Michelangelo kind of way. I look at some of those sculptors and or the pieces, and they seem to be so intimate and in details and beautiful, and they contain a lot of feelings of patience to coax the sculpture out of the stone. I don't see that in today's sculpture. Same thing with your book. I see it very peaceful, although it's a tragic story, and just a lot of time put in it. I suspected it wasn't something that was put out in a short time, because it feels very, very loving and very thought out. A love of the book, not the character. You know, sometimes it's what people do to each other in the name of humanity is horrible, but I just wanted to make that comment and see if
I did love writing this book. I mean, I really enjoyed it. I have a very, very careful editor with a wonderful eye at Bantam, and she asked me to do 5 revisions, which I did, and I was lucky to work with her. And I just, you know, her vision for the book was that it be the best it could be, and that was mine also, so that was really fortunate. But I really wanted to write something that would reach people and that would come out of some of my own experiences as a healer and as a human being who's sort of alive and thinking.
I want to talk to you more about being a healer later on, but I want to talk a bit about the book. Right in the beginning, Father John is speaking, obviously, to a superior, and he suggests that there are certain truths that need to be hidden from the public. Is that something that goes all the way through the book?
Yes, well, Luca, the main character, he doesn't age, as you sort of mentioned briefly. He comes from in the end, he discovers why that's true, and the church knows about his people, and they're hiding the knowledge of that from, you know, the general populace. You know, that's sort of the fictional premise of the novel. And because the knowledge of this people would give an alternative version of history that the church doesn't want known.
One of the questions that came in from our audience before we ever started this show, just when we put the information up, let me read it to you because I just found it tremendous. Here it is. In your research, did you find other things besides immortality that the church is withholding from us? And why do you think ideas that would make us a better race are being withheld? Do you have an opinion about that?
I do. And I'm going to start off by saying that I think there is at the heart of Roman Catholicism something very beautiful, and that has to do with the truth of humanity and a spiritual truth. That said, historically, from what I've researched and from what I can see, that, and this is part of why we all love the Da Vinci Code, the Catholic Church has been very interested and very invested in secular power and in controlling the masses. And because of that, there are certain pieces of history that they know about that they may or may not have released. So, for example, you know, in the Da Vinci Code, that Jesus was married and had a family. And so that was sort of part of my premise. And I do think it's my personal opinion that there's plenty in the Vatican archives that they don't want us to know about. And I wish, you know, there would be some disclosure. But I think there always has been and always will be governments or certain bodies with power that hide parts of the truth from the general public. I don't know that I came across anything specific, although there is this sort of tradition of an immortal race of people, a very long-lived race of people. There's a sort of, you know, if you start researching it, Melchizedek and, you know, the early forefathers of the Bible, and there's certain other kinds of, you know, the rabbi who cursed Jesus and the rabbi who, and the one who helped Jesus carry the cross, the beloved disciple. There are people who are said to live forever, and there's this sort of vein of this legend sort of running through the legends of the world. So that was sort of part of the research I did.
Is this a hidden race?
Well, it is in the novel, and it seems to be in the legends. There's a wonderful Australian magazine called Nexus magazine that presents sort of alternative science, alternative theories, some of its paranoid conspiracy theories. I love conspiracy theories. I think they're interesting. At least that means people are awake and questioning what's being told to us. You know, the media is run by a very few handful of people who definitely have their own agenda. So I always like it when an alternative is presented, even if the alternative is kind of kooky. But anyways, Nexus magazine once ran a little short blurb about some brothers in the south of France who seem to have lived for several hundred years. So there seems to be there's a little bit of a legend about that.
So you're not really talking about reincarnation, you're talking about physically living. Well, like the Never-Ending Story, I don't know if that was a Disney thing or what, but about the guy who left everybody behind because he kept living and staying very young. I love that movie.
Oh, I didn't see it, but I'll have to see it, Sherry. It sounds great.
It's kind of old, and it was about the woman that he was in love with, and would she drink from this well to keep herself young and wait for him while he had to go do something else. And she chose to live a regular life rather than wait for him.
Isn't that interesting, the choices we all make?
It's beautiful. Well, you've got this great acceptance in the U.S. Is it being translated into other languages?
Yes, it's already out in Russia and Poland and just came out recently in Spain. And it will be out in Brazil and Serbia and I guess Greece. It will be out in Greece in August.
Awesome. Do you think the book is well, it's very well written, but because of the things like the Da Vinci Code and The Secret and...
Well, you know, The Secret, the stuff from The Secret, a lot of it comes right out of Renaissance Florence. Cosimo de' Medici founded the Platonic Academy with Marsilio Ficino, and the people who came through that, they created this sort of new school of thought, a Neoplatonism, and part of what they were saying is that people create their own reality. And you can see that in Pico della Mirandola's essay, Oration on the Dignity of Man, where he says, we're so lucky, we're like gods, we can create our own reality. So this secret, you know, this new knowledge isn't so new. It comes, you know, it's hundreds of years old.
But people think it's new.
Well, I think we keep rediscovering it every generation.
Oh. Okay, I'm going to give out the call-out numbers if you guys would like to call in and talk to Tracy. The toll-free number in the U.S. is 877-876-5227. In Canada, 888-815-9756. And if you can't get through those lines, try the direct line, 530-876-3222. I kind of hurried through those. You can go to bbsboysam.com, and you can get the numbers there. This is Station 1 tonight that we're on. And a lot of our listeners like to write us, so radio@vocalprofiling.com. And we have two more now emails that came in for you, so we'll get to those.
Great.
Let me look down through here. I have a ton of questions for you. Can you, or do you, in all your digging, did you ever find out what the Holy Grail mysteries, what's hidden? You know, they're going and looking for it, but what is it?
I don't know that I've taken a stand all that on that, or that I've found it. I thought the Sang Real, the royal blood, is as likely as anything else. I have been toying around with the idea of a Lancelot book myself because I'm attracted to historical fiction. I'm much more interested in the story of Ragnell, who was cursed to be beautiful at night and ugly during the day. So I've sort of, that would be my entry point. But it's sort of an archetype for the thing we search for that keeps us being our best self. At least that's where the way I'm interpreting it now, sort of thinking about a book I might want to do in a few years.
Well, I certainly hope you follow up with this one. It'd be wonderful. If the Catholic Church is withholding ideas from us, what's the reason? And is that being followed through now by our own government? That's one of the questions that came in. It was a very long question that they wrote, and I just tried to summarize it there.
Well, I think it must be secular... you know, secular power, secular control, that, you know, sticking to the party line. Here's the testament, the one testament, the only testament. This is our doctrine. If you want to be Catholic, you have to follow it. And I think there is something very wonderful at the heart of Catholicism, but I'm not sure that codifying any specific group of documents from the first, second, third, or fourth century following, you know, Christ is makes that the one true testament.
So in things like The Secret, that's the information that's coming out. And when what these people are asking you on this email is, do you think that same censorship is still going on today in our media and our government? Are they?
Oh, I absolutely think we're being censored all the time. Where's the real nitty-gritty news about Iraq, I mean, and Iran? What, you know, we are absolutely being censored all the time. The media is constantly being solidified into fewer and fewer hands. I think you know, I try to check online at BBC, the BBC website every day, because we don't get that much good information in American newscasting. It's very political. I had a friend who used to teach at the Columbia School of Journalism who had connections to the New York Times. There were certainly times when the New York Times was called by high-ranking people in the White House who said, sit on this story and we'll scratch your back later, and they did. It happens all the time. It's real politics. In the real world, information is power, and it is bartered around. I certainly think we aren't being told the whole truth, the nothing but the truth, on a number of subjects. And as best we can do, I think because we have access to the Internet, sample around to a lot of different websites, you know, read broadly, and then you can sort of piece the truth together for yourself as best you can.
Can you sort of hint, don't give the book away because I want people to buy it, but at some of these ideas that were hidden that you talk about in your book?
Well, the main thing in the book is this race of people with extraordinary longevity and this alternative history of the world, that there's another history. And the alternative history I didn't make up either. I sort of gathered it from a number of sources, including Zechariah Sitchin. Some people might be familiar with his readings of the Old Testament and ancient Akkadian and Sumerian scriptures. And also there's some information about alchemy and that sort of thing in the book.
Is this a book that's going to be put in a category of magic or history? Or I didn't look it up to see what genre it was listed in.
I think there's been a, I think the genres, because there's a love story in it, and it's a historical novel, and then there's a sort of science fiction thing at the very end. So I think people, and there's a lot of magic in terms of the alchemy, and the Kabbalah, there's a lot of spiritual information in this book. I think that finding a category for it has been a little tricky.
Do you believe in reincarnation?
Personally?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah, I do. I personally have memories that seem to come from other lifetimes.
Did you dig into any of those for this book?
You know, this is the first time I've been asked about that, but I've wondered it. Not consciously. I mean, the one lifetime I have just a few snippets of information and have had validated in healings, in the healing situation that's sort of close to this is I was once a traveling actor in the Commedia dell'arte.
That little signal means that we have a caller.
Okay.
For a question or two.
Sure, I have two quick ones, just a quick observation. When I worked in military intelligence, we did intercepts on some of the stories that news writers had written from overseas, and when they got to the States, they were totally different than the information that was sent in, so it correlates exactly with what you're speaking about. The second item I have a question for you is that have you taken a look at any of Eric John Phelps' work?
I don't know that work. And thank you for the comment about the news stories being changed when they got here. That I really appreciate that. And I don't know his work. Do you recommend it?
I do. It's got a lot to do with what you're speaking about tonight, but I'll let you continue. It's fascinating what you're speaking about, and I look forward to more.
How do you spell his last name?
Thanks for calling.
How do you spell his last name?
I believe it's P-H-E-L-P-S. It's E-R-I-C. J-O-N Phelps, P-H-E-L-P-S.
Eric John Phelps.
Okay, thank you, caller.
Thank you.
Where do you get the ideas? Do you just let your characters kind of evolve themselves, or do you just put an outline and you know where you're going? How does the book happen?
Well, I think every author has a different process. For me, I work back and forth between an outline and between inspiration. I usually give myself a loose, kind of a loose outline, and then I pull back and see where I go, and then I come back to the outline and, have to do a lot of revision and shaping So I'm always moving back and forth between the kind of the unbounded creative, you know, the rush of creativity that's so much fun, and then the structure and the shaping that's so important to really craft something. And this book just came out of my love for Renaissance art and for it came out of a lot of my experiences as a healer. You know, one of the things I'm trying to do with this book is sort of explore some questions about the nature of suffering. There's all these heartaches that we all face all the time. This is the small personal heartaches, you know, sort of family problems, financial problems, loss of a job, loss of a loved one through divorce or through sickness or through death or through just, you know, alienation. Kind of, you know, our interpersonal and life experience heartaches that we have all the time. And then there's the larger transpersonal heartaches, which are war, poverty, plague, cataclysm, you know, these sort of that affect massive swaths of humanity. And, you know, so how do we, when we face this all the time as people, and, you know, every life has trouble, how do we find our faith in God, our faith in goodness, our faith in truth and beauty and love? How do we find it when we're facing these heartaches all the time? So, I wanted to address that in some way that I hoped would move people and would help them. There's so many books in my life that I've read and loved and that gave me something, and that when a dark time came for me, as they inevitably do, I could think back on this book or this poem, and it just gave me some measure of, you know, faith and trust and hope. So that's what I was, one of the things I was hoping to do with Immortal.
Well, my next question was, what do you want your audience to get from your book? So right down the line here, as I've written out some questions, you seem to be answering them before I ask them. So are you just psychic that way?
Well, I think we all are. We're all we live in this big field of information, and we all sort of connect telepathically and, I don't know, vibrationally. We just connect all the time in all these ways.
So you wrote this book because the story needed to come out, you had the interest, and you want your audience to take away the idea that it can be a better world? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Well, I don't know if I have any answers. I guess I have questions, and I wanted to show, you know, Luca makes specific choices for love. You know, he faces the worst happens to Luca, my main character, over and over again in Immortal. And it's called Immortal, and no one's left standing. This book is about loss, you know, in some profound way. So, but he still keeps choosing imperfectly, because we're all such imperfect people, certainly me foremost among the imperfect people I know. But Luca still keeps choosing love, and he keeps choosing, you know, his sort of faith in something, even though he questions, is there an evil God as well as a good God? I guess I want people to take hope away, and I'm hoping to give them, you know, one of the great things that art can do, whether it's a song or a painting or a sculpture or a book, is it can give you some, you know, you can't, inarticulable, almost inarticulable moment of bliss that you take with you when something happens in your life and you can draw on it. It nurtures people. It nurtures your soul. I hope that this book would nurture people's soul in the way that so many books and paintings and sculptures and music have nurtured me.
So in the book, there's a political fight, there's personal fights, there's universal fights, there's historical, I don't want to say fights, I guess, pulls in different directions.
Well, we all live in this complicated web that's, you know, our family, our friends, our town, our country, our world. You know, we live in this sort of complicated, intertwining web that's constantly shifting and reorganizing itself.
I'm reading another email here. It seems kind of a weird email, but I'll read it to you. I read that there is an organization in California that's broadcasting frequencies to people claiming they can heal them. They are using psychotronic equipment. They put a picture in a container and then with their mind send people energy. Is this a scam, or does stuff like this really exist and work?
I have heard of something called I think it's radionics. It sounds familiar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the healing world, there's certainly plenty of scam artists selling snake oil. There are also people who are real and who really have a gift for healing and whose intention is, you know, is very pure. And I think You had Lynn McTaggart on recently, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so she wrote the book about intention, the power of intention, the intention experiment. So she cites a lot of the research that's been done, very recent scientific research, showing the efficacy of prayer and hands-on healing. So some of it's real, and some of it isn't, and we just have to be good discerners. We have to, you know, find out for ourselves, is it real or are they selling snake oil? So I don't know that organization. It could be run by people who really want to help other people. Or it could be people just trying to, you know, turn a fast buck. I don't know. Do the research.
Are you allowed to tell us who was after your character for being burnt at the stake? Was it government? If it gives away the plot, don't tell us, but...
Well, it was an organization that was sort of imagined them to be this confraternity. They're called the Confraternity of the Red Feather, and they are under the umbrella of the Inquisition. The Inquisition, murdered hundreds of thousands of people. So hundreds of thousands of people in horrible, brutal ways. So this confraternity that was tracking down Luca was sort of under their aegis.
So it's the same kind of thing with the church and the government wanting people not to have certain information that may make them free.
Right.
For those of you just tuned in, we're talking to Tracy L. Slatton, author of Immortal, a subject I think the older generation would take more seriously. I know until I turned 60, I really didn't take into consideration, okay, I need to think about dying and how that's going to happen. And in doing some of your research about death and dying, did you take a look at what age people start thinking about death and immortality?
No, it didn't occur to me to do that. It's sort of an interesting tack.
Well, it's just kind of crazy, young people out doing daredevil things, and as we get older, we start taking less and less risks about what's going on. Your health goes down the drain and things like that, which is one of the things that we do here.
I think aging is not for the faint of heart. I think it's very hard. I have a very dear friend in his 70s, and, it begins to be difficult. And it takes a lot of courage to sort of face the travails of the body as the body starts to let us down in different ways. But my grandmother used to say to me, you either get old or you die young. So I'm sort of voting for getting old myself.
That's a good choice. Tell us about your Barbara Brennan training, and do you have a healing practice?
I don't have a practice now. In 2000 or 2001, right around then, all my clients, I had never advertised, clients had just come to me, and then they just all left, and it was time for me to start writing full-time. And the universe was very clear with me, sent me just absolutely unmixed signals. But I do, informally, I work on my kids and my husband and my friends. I have a network of friends who are healers, and they'll call and ask for healings, and so I'll do that.
Do you think that healing that comes through you when Barbara Brennan's teaching laying off hands, healing, and energy comes through you, is that kind of the same way that the creativity of your book kind of comes through?
Yes. Every page is agony when I write. But that said, there are moments when, just moments, that I sort of live for when I feel like a clear pane of glass with a light shining through it. And it's a very similar feeling to when I'm serving as a healer and I've been able to put aside, the small ego and stand in an open heart with love and the intention to heal, grounded, centered, and connected to the divine. And something just, comes through me that's really a wonderful feeling.
And the book just kind of writes itself?
Well, every page is agony. It rewrites itself 5 times, I guess, in the case of Immortal.
Well, it's a wonderful book. Do you have a favorite part of the book that you could tell us about?
Well, my favorite part, because it's lighter, is when Luca becomes the tutor to the young Leonardo da Vinci. And, I read through some of the translations of Leonardo's notebooks, and I read Vasari's Lives of the Artists, and Leonardo has been written about by so many people for so many hundreds of years, and there's wonderful books written about him and all kinds of speculation and theories. So little is known. So I got to invent this character of Leonardo when he's 10 and 11 and a young man, and it was just so much fun. I really enjoyed writing that, creating this, imagining, you know, Leonardo has to be one of the top five most interesting people ever to live. So who was he when he was a child? Well, I envisioned him as this most mesmerizing, you know, precocious child, and he was known to be very, very handsome. Vasari comments on it. He was very gracious. He had this sort of calmness streaming off him. So imagining that as a young boy, so that was fun. And people who read the book, you know, love that part because there's sort of, there's a lightness that comes through in Luca's interactions with this young Leonardo.
In your look at immortality as sort of a magic thing, did you also look at for health aspects of how people could keep themselves younger?
Well, Luca, in the book, he has some kind of fantastic immune system because he never gets sick, and he heals much faster than other people. So I sort of figured if you were going to live forever, the way that would have to, or, you know, for hundreds, perhaps thousands of years, the way that would have to work is that you'd have to have, like, a killer immune system that, and just recuperate so quickly.
One of the things that, we're doing here is looking at anti-aging, and the program that we've made out of that, we call it Rejuvenation, and we're sort of modeling after an article that we saw in Reader's Digest about aging, and it does mention the immune system and how it goes down in terms of a lot of inflammation, like wheat, like what they've done to distort our wheat and cause inflammation. And that's killing.
Right, you want to talk about government censorship? Let's talk about the FDA and the way they've kept information about the pollution of our food sources here in the United States, and it's the adulteration of the good stuff in our food here in the United States. That is one of the great scandals of the 20th and early 21st century. The government is absolutely not doing us a favor in genetically modified foods, and you know, I talk about this sometimes, you go to Italy, they are very against, they are violently against genetically modified foods and all the chemicals we use. You can eat a couple of apricots, and they're imperfect looking. They're a little spotty, they're not the most perfect shape, but they're so delicious. I feel like I've feasted. You come here, you try to eat a couple of apricots, they look beautiful because they've got fish genes spliced in to make them shiny and orange. But when you eat them, there's no sense of satiation. There's no sense of satisfaction. They taste like watery cardboard with a little apricot sugar thrown in, and you don't get the same experience at all. What the government in the United States is allowing to be done to our food supply in the name of big pharma, and the FDA has become nothing but a shill for chemical, pharmaceutical, and biotech stock companies. It's mind-blowing to me.
Sounds
and it's
like
not being reported the way it should be.
Sounds like another book coming up. Well, if you read some of the information, and Larry Trivieri is digging into this, he's a writer about health, alternative health. He says that they're modifying the wheat to take out particularly thiamin, B1, and in that case, that's destroying our immune system. It's destroying our ability to use something called thymopoietin, which is put out by the thymus, and keeps us healthy. And we're seeing that again and again and again. The frequency that we use for thymopoietin can reverse immune disorders. Cat allergies, sneezing, that kind of thing, just almost immediately. The other adults,
and you can take it as a supplement, or how do you?
It's just like music in the air, but it's a frequency that entrains your brain waves. So it's actually entraining the brain to send out the signal to the thymus to make it.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that we're finding incredibly horrid in the autism that we're working on this month is the allergies with wheat and milk and eggs that these children have. And they culture these vaccinations on the egg and wheat and milk. So they're getting it by the vaccination. It's already set up a predisposition for them to have immune problems. So, you know, I'd like to see a real book about this and what the government's doing. And
we need a great book like Rachel Carson's Silent Spring that was sort of this mind-blowing, whistleblowing book about the environment, and she was sort of the, you know, brought it to our attention in a new way. We need a great book like Silent Spring in terms of what big pharma and chemical, the biotech companies are doing to our food supply here in the United States. We need one of those whistleblowers. So many people are afraid, I think.
What's her last name?
Well, the book I'm referencing is called Silent Spring, and the woman was Rachel Carson.
C-A-R-S-O-N?
Yes, this is a book, I came out 25 or 30 years ago, and it just was, it sent shockwaves through, you know, the people who read it, and was a very, very famous book. And we need a book like that about the food supply.
Well, I think people are waking up because they just trusted their doctors and their government to tell them the truth. And it's not real anymore. You can't trust your doctor because the HMO pushing them and the drug company's pushing them to sell this medication to you or prescribe it, and they get a kickback, and they say that's not true, but it totally is. So I just think the populace are being screwed all the way around.
I think so. I feel sorry for doctors because so many of them really mean well.
Yeah.
And that between, you know, malpractice insurance and the demands of the HMO, they're really, you know, they're more screwed than the rest of us, I think. At least the ones who really actually want to help and heal people.
But their hands are tied. They get 15 minutes if it's a heart condition and 2 minutes if it's a migraine. And they're so dictated to by the HMOs, they just can't get out from under it. It made me so mad when I went to my doctor, and he charged like $70 for a visit, and I was talking to his receptionist, and she said, you know, the doctor only gets $30 of this.
Oh.
The insurance company's going to keep the rest.
Right.
So I dumped my insurance, and I just have catastrophic insurance now, and I get to pay my doctor what he deserves, and I get to go see the doctor I want. So I'm hoping everybody starts.
Well, I think what that will go back to is tort reform. I think we've got to figure, you know, ultimately we're going to have to do something very uncomfortable, and that's place a value on human life so that doctors aren't paying, like, you know, if they charge $100 to see you, they're not paying 80 of it to a malpractice insurance company. And so that, you know, if your baby dies during childbirth, the most you can get is $2 million or whatever it is. And then this sort of tort reform so that people can't. And the problem is there are great doctors, good doctors, mediocre doctors, and straight up bad doctors out there, just like there's a bell curve like in any other profession. So the bad doctors who are liable and who actually have done something horrible that they, you know, should pay for, you know, they're not going to pay as much as they should, but the sort of tort reform and, you know, making sure that doctors don't have to pay everything they make in malpractice insurances, I think it's really important. I think it's part of why the HMOs have a stranglehold on doctors and people.
Well, one of the things we can do is read Immortal and see what that's like and go for it, and we don't need the doctors and their crap. There is a healthcare idea coming up in the presidential candidate. I like your opinion. So what's your opinions of the candidates about health care and health reform?
I think there's no quick fix to health care and health reform. I think it's gonna be some time. And health care and health reform, there are so many lobbyists and so many people with a finger in the pie and the insurance companies and the HMOs. It's either going to be something quick, drastic, and really bloody to change things, like massive overhaul of the, you know, the tort reform. So if your doctor cuts off your leg when he meant to remove your appendix, you only get $1 million or whatever it is. You know, that no longer happens. So it's either going to be, you know, quick, fast, really bloody, and anger a lot of people, or it's going to take, you know, sort of the wisdom of Solomon and 10 years of the best minds in the country trying to figure it out. That said, I'm a registered Democrat. I was very torn between Hillary and Barack Obama, and when I, at the primary in New York, I didn't know who I was going to vote for until I stood there. At the last minute, I thought, I want change, and I pulled the lever for Barack Obama. But I have reservations about him. Is he a Washington outsider? Can he really do, you know, is he too much outside the system to make an efficient change, a real change? Is he all talk and not enough experience? Hillary, I like the fact that she's got this ace up her sleeve, and by that I mean Bill. Bill is an ace up her sleeve. He's great at being a politician, and he's a smart man. I think he can help her. She does seem cold and wooden. So I have reservations about both candidates. But I like them both also. So
I don't particularly like Hillary's health reform, that everybody has to have insurance and it has to be done a government way, and if you want to do alternatives, tough, that's not going to be part of it. I don't like being slopped into that corner. Is there any idea in your book that this is from the core of our being to see this idea of we're immortal and that somehow we're creating our own health problems and we don't have to do that?
Well, Luca does at one point. I'm just going to a scene in the book, sort of two-thirds of the way through. Luca witnesses the sack of Volterra, and he sees Lorenzo de' Medici's army under Federigo Montefeltro, the Duke of Urbino, marches into the city and sacks it, and the people haven't really done anything. They were threatening to give Lorenzo problems because of some alum mines, but they hadn't done it yet. But Lorenzo was a very young man, newly in charge of Florence. He was, I think, in his early 20s, mid-20s at the latest, and the vultures were circling. You know, the Pope had two quote-unquote nephews that were probably his illegitimate sons that he wanted to put in charge of Florence, and, you know, the alliance that had sort of held under his grandfather Cosimo was shaky, and he was sending a message to everyone that if push comes to shove, he would push back. So he flattened this. He did this horrible, devastating sack of the city of Volterra, the town of Volterra, beautiful hilly city, and Luca witnesses this young girl getting raped, and he saves her from being killed at the hands of the soldiers, the mercenary soldiers, Lorenzo's mercenary soldiers, and he talks to her, and she says to him, I don't know if I'll be able to have children, because she's 12 or 13 at the time, and he says to her, she's shown some evidence that she's not going to let this brutal rape crush her spirit and destroy her, and he looks at her, he says, you'll have children, you'll find a husband, and she says, how do you know that? And he says to her, I've always found that the inner mind determines what will happen to you. Someone who wants to die will. Someone who wants to live will. So that's the sort of intimate moment where I think I'm addressing the question.
I believe that your book is going to become a classic for people who believe in the soul and the will. I'm very happy Heather chose it to be on the show. Are you available for lectures and workshops and things like that? You have some really good ideas and opinions about what ought to happen.
Sure. I'm actually speaking at I'm going up to talk to at Southern Connecticut State University. A professor there read the book and loved it and got in touch with me, and so I'm going to go this week and speak to his class. I'm looking forward to it.
Is it about the content of the book or how to write a book?
I think it's art history and the content of the book.
Oh, how can people get in touch with you?
I have a website, tracylslatin.com, and people can email me through that.
And what else is on your website that they can look at?
Well, let's see, lots of pictures of my husband's sculpture, and there's directs you to a blog. I keep a blog, just sort of ramblings and thoughts and ideas and poems and opinions, very, very idiosyncratic opinions. And there's a discussion page for people to sort of chime in what they felt about Immortal and how they feel about Florence, because Florence, the city of Florence, is a character in Immortal. And then there's, you know, a list of my other publications and that kind of thing.
Can you talk about, for a minute, the Indian book that you did?
I have Native American blood, but do you mean the nonfiction book, Piercing
Yes.
Time and Space?
Yes.
That's a book on science and spirituality, and it's sort of where they meet. And I profiled the work of American physicist William Tiller and British biologist Rupert Sheldrake and American mystic Edgar Cayce, and I was sort of trying to find out where Tiller's quantum theory and Rupert Sheldrake's morphic fields and the Akashic fields, as Edgar Cayce talked about them, where they intersected, where they were alike.
Boy, that is awesome. So I'd never heard that you'd done another book. I thought this one was the first one. And Rupert Sheldrake, in talking about morphogenic resonance for our audience, He says that all the plants, well, everything has a frequency, a harmony, a resonance, and that dictates the shape of the leaves, the color, the shape of the seeds, how the plant lives. And our work here is to take that a step further and to do it with humans.
Mm.
And through vocal profiling, we're able to tell what diseases, what genetic issues they have, what their personality is. So what's the name of this book again for people?
It's called Piercing Time and Space, and it was put out by the ARE Press.
Definitely, I'm going to go get that.
Well, thank you.
Is there any thoughts that you want to leave with our audience to encourage them to buy your book and also to do self-healing?
Well, I think in the face of these things that happen to us all the time, that, you know, loving ourselves and compassion for the self is so important. And this is one of the big issues that I struggle with every day, because I'm very hard on myself and tend to be hard on the people around me, so they're not always appreciative of that. So self-love, and I think that's what Luca comes to. One of the things I say about Immortal is that it's a journey of the heart and an education of the heart and a journey of faith. And what, you know, Luca finds love, self-love, and, you know, love for other people. So if people read Immortal, I hope they come away, you know, with more love in their lives and something wonderful to hold on to in times when they may need something wonderful.
Well, it certainly stirs the imagination to what's possible. Luca is, 185 years old?
Yes, at the end of the book, about 185.
I think one of the things that The Secret has done is to open people to this idea that they can be whole and healthy and have what they want. But I also think one of the things The Secret left out is, what do we really want from our core? And I think your book really helps people go to core thought and bring that out. So I'm going to finish the book, and it'll probably be even better. I encourage all of you to go to Amazon or your local bookstore. I think I found it at Amazon for $11. It was retail for, I think, $14.
Yes, I think that's right.
This price, and Amazon had it for $11.20, those great Amazon discounts. So I encourage everyone to go buy the book. We'll put up a little review as the show, so that you can get in touch with Tracy. And Tracy, thank you so much for being with us. We're out of time.
Oh, Sherry, thanks for having me on. I really enjoyed myself. I appreciate it much.
And if you're going to do another book, let us know. Or if there's other things you want to talk about, just tell Heather and we'll have you back on.
Absolutely. Thank you.
You are welcome. And for those of you who want to join us with some of our programming and to look at some of your issues of anti-aging and this new rejuvenation program that we have, it includes information about telomerase, the little copper top on the end of your nerve, about insulin resistance, about inflammation that Tracy was talking about carotenoids and flavonoids, about how to lower your glucose. Really, it's an evaluation of what in your life and what in your biochemistry can keep you from aging gracefully or maybe not aging at all. So if you'd like to join us for that research project, you can write to Heather, H-E-A-T-H-E-R, at vocalprofiling.com. You can jump on our website at Nutrasounds, Nutrasounds.com, and get in touch with us that way. But we're looking for guinea pigs, and so write to us, and we'll get that information to you. Okay, we'll be signing off now, but join us on Thursday for our show, Vocal Profiling. And for those of you who want to hear some profiles of Obama and Hillary and McCain, we've done those for you, and we'll be posting them about their personality and how that will fit into what you want as a president. Thanks for joining us.
And the sunlight fades my eyes. Something without the moon. And I know it's all just
day. Someone else can say the way. Always seems to know the way. Then I go see. And my world's all brighter again. Yeah, just on the baby. And I know it's gonna be, gonna be, gonna be.